The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
You'll recall the prophets of the Old Testament of the Christian Bible were astute and often passionate critics of communities they believed had lost their way. In that regard, Bury's voice is certainly prophetic. He graphically decries the degradation of the natural world and its inhabitants, including its human inhabitants. Degradation that's inflicted by the twin forces of unbridled industrial capitalism and excessive self-absorption. In his essay, Our Deserted Country, he points out that the objective of industrial capitalism has remained unchanged since the advent of the Industrial Revolution. Quote, to cheapen work by displacing workers, thus increasing the flow of wealth from the less wealthy to the more wealthy. Achieving that objective succeeds by exploiting natural resources with little or no regard for its effect on living things, or for limits imposed by nature itself. Achieving the objective relentlessly destroys ecosystems upon which we know ultimately all life depends. And achieving the objective relegates people to commodities in a job market and grooms them for the role of self-absorbed consumers, compelled to satisfy every real or imagined need with the latest gimmick, gadget, or trend marketed by our corporate overlords. Here now is Wendell Bury reading his poem, The Objective.
Even while I dreamed, I prayed that what I saw was only fear and no foretelling. For I saw the last known landscape destroyed for the sake of the objective. The soil bulldozed, the rock blasted. Those who had wanted to go home would never get there now. I saw the forest reduced to stumps and gullies. I saw the poisoned river, the mountain cast into the valley. I came to the city that nobody recognized because it looked like every other city. Men and women and children now pursued the objective as if nobody ever had pursued it before. The once enslaved, the once oppressed were now free to sell themselves to the highest bidder and to enter the best paying prisons in pursuit of the objective, which was the destruction of all enemies, which was the destruction of all obstacles, which was to clear the way to victory, which was to clear the way to self-creation, from which nobody who ever wanted to go home would ever get there now. For every remembered place had been displaced, every love unloved, every vow unsworn, to make way for the passage of the crowd, of the individuated, the autonomous, the self-actuated, the homeless, with their many eyes opened only toward the objective, which they did not yet perceive in the far distance, having never known where they were going, having never known where they came from.
He sees the big picture, one that can be unsettling, ugly, alarming. Yet he never loses sight of the beauty, majesty, and mystery of the natural world. And he never loses hope that in time, nature can heal itself and us. His poem, Slowly, Slowly They Return, draws us to a woodland ravaged by deforestation, where signs of recovery and renewal nurture that hope. Slowly, slowly they return to the small woodland let alone. Great trees outspreading and upright, apostles of the living light. Patient as stars, they build in air, tier after tier, a timbered choir. Stout beams upholding weightless grace of song, a blessing on this place. They stand in waiting all around, uprisings of their native ground, downcomings of the distant light. They are the advent they await. Receiving sun and giving shade, they are a benefaction made, and is a benediction said over the living and the dead. In fall, their brightened leaves released fly down the wind, and we are pleased to walk on radiance, amazed. O light, come down to earth, be praised. That poem, with its images of a timbered choir and stout beams upholding weightless grace of song, has inspired composers to set the words to music. In fact, our gray hymnal, Singing the Living Tradition, includes one such setting. And another setting is by American musician and composer Malcolm Dalgleish. And our musical meditation this morning features the McLean's College Choir performing Great Trees, Dalgleish's setting of the poem you just heard. Time I hear that, I kind of get choked up. Sorry. It's just such a beautiful tribute to what we have all around us all the time, really. If we would only stop, look, and see. Most of us, I believe, are familiar with hymn number 145 in our gray hymnal, As Tranquil Streams. Some of us, too, are aware that the words of this song, written in 1933, celebrated the growing connection between Unitarians and Universalists. And the final verse of the song describes the emerging Unitarian and Universalist faith community as a prophetic church, declares that the future awaits our liberating ministry, and urges our prophetic church to go forward in the power of love and proclaim the truth that makes us free. But what makes a voice prophetic? Are prophetic voices speaking to us today? Are we listening to them? Should we be? I mean, what's at risk if we ignore these voices? And how can prophetic voices be liberating? I came across a characterization of the prophetic voice in a 2009 program developed by the Social Justice Ministries of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And I quote, "The ancient biblical prophets, like Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Amos, did more than receive messages from God and predict the future. The prophets were consistent voices for justice. They called on everyone, from kings to peasants, to change their ways and align their actions with the most high, most loving, and most just values of their society. But the prophets didn't just speak, they lived their values, often at considerable risk." To that description, I would add that the greatest prophets are able to speak in language that's elevated, yet accessible to everyday people. They direct attention to immediate issues, of course, but always in the context of the big picture of where we've come from, where we are, where we're headed. They speak the language of the heart, not just of the head. And they are masters of language. They use symbols, metaphors, personifications that command attention and heighten awareness of the conditions they address. By all these measures, Wendell Berry is a prophet. For over 50 years, he's lived the values he speaks of. He has farmed that land in north central Kentucky with horses, not tractors, by the way. And he's written eloquently about the land and about how we use and too often abuse the land and how we mindlessly squander its bounty. His poetry, along with his essays and his increasingly more frequent speeches, proclaim the spiritual essence of the natural world and the existential crisis we've created by desecrating that world. You know, what's more, in more ways than we could possibly address this morning, everyone, Berry preaches the fundamental truth that all our UU principles are inextricably linked to our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. As he once wrote, "It is only on condition of humility and reverence before the world that our species can survive in it." Think about that. Human worth and dignity, freedom, social justice, peace, democratic processes, spiritual fulfillment, all ultimately depend on the capacity of the natural world to support and sustain life. I mean, climate change is, of course, a prominent factor in our current existential crisis, but so is economic inequality, human oppression, depletion of resources, reduction of land productivity and water productivity, and threats to human health and welfare. And we can trace all those social, economic, health, and political problems to the basic question: how do we extract, distribute, and use the resources Earth provides? In one of his more virulent attacks on the system and its objective, Berry once wrote, quote, "No amount of fiddling with capitalism can for long disguise its failure to conserve the wealth and health of nature." And he goes on to say, "Eroded, wasted, or degraded soils, damaged or destroyed ecosystems, extinction of biodiversity species, whole landscapes defaced, gouged, flooded, or blown up," as we saw in that trailer earlier in our service. "Thoughtless squandering of fossil fuels and fossil waters, of mineable minerals and ores, natural health and beauty replaced by a heartless and sickening ugliness. Perhaps its greatest success is an astounding increase in the destructiveness and therefore the profitability of war." Now, hearing that, you might be tempted to judge Berry's messages overall as primarily or ultimately political, but that's not really the case. He digs deeper than the politics and the current events. He believes that what drives the entire enterprise is how we view the natural world and our place in it, whether we love the earth or merely assign monetary value to it. Now, Bury's own view derives from his religious faith. He self-identifies as a Christian, although quite an eccentric one by any standard. His faith really is more in harmony with universalism and with the Unitarianism of Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Ellery Channing, and Henry David Thoreau, our eminent ancestors here. It's more in harmony with them than with any of the mainstream Christian denominations, and God forbid, with Christian fundamentalists, especially those megachurches preaching the gospel of prosperity. We get a lot of insight into the nature of his faith from an interview that aired on October 2013 on Moyers and Company. It was called Wendell Berry, Poet and Prophet. In that interview, Bill Moyers asked Berry to read one of his most beloved poems, The Peace of Wild Things. Remember, it's one of the four readings derived from Berry's writings that's included in our gray hymnal. Let me share that with you now. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Bill Moyers asked Berry to elaborate on the word grace in that poem. I meant it in the religious sense, Berry replied, and he went on. People of religious faith know that the world is maintained every day by the same force that created it. It's an article of my faith and belief that all creatures live by breathing God's breath and participating in his spirit. And this means that the whole thing is holy, the whole shooting match. There are no sacred and unsacred places. There are only sacred and desecrated places. Deserted places would include those we saw in the video background to the objective, like those gouges in surface mine country. To Berry, those gouges are not just land abuse, not just human oppression. They're a desecration, a blasphemy. Inevitably, as Berry becomes more of a public figure associated with the conservation and sustainable agriculture movement across the country and around the world, and with protests against strip mining and water pollution in his home state of Kentucky. At the age of 79, he was a participant in a sit-in in the governor's office in Kentucky. So now Berry's often pressed to offer solutions to the environmental crisis we face. And with great humility and authenticity, he does publicize ideas on right ways of farming, right ways of managing forests, right ways to live so as not to inflict irreparable harm on our only world. He endorses the so-called 50-year farm bill. Now, the title is a satirical rebuke to those top-down, short-sighted, five-year plans that corporate honchos and totalitarian bureaucrats routinely devise. But this document is a serious document that offers many practical ideas for healing the earth and sustaining its productivity for generations to come. Ideas like eliminating no-till agriculture and factory farming. It calls for reversing the ratio of annual and perennial plantings on our arable land. The ratio today is 80% annual crops, corn, soybean, sugarcane, et cetera, to 20% perennial flora, grains and grasses, for example. This agricultural economy requires, of course, extensive use of herbicides, pesticides, and fossil fuels. It results in extensive soil depletion and erosion. The 50-year farm bill calls for gradual transition to 80% perennial to 20% annual planting. But probably more than anything, Wendell Berry himself is a living example of thoughtful, responsible approaches to everything from planting and harvesting crops, to raising livestock, to building peaceful, sustainable communities in rural as well as in urban scapes. And his work and his life embody the irrefutable truth that right action, taking the right actions, derives from clear thinking and from love. He has said so many times in so many ways, in essence, what we love, we want to take care of. We take responsibility for what we love. And if we love the earth and the people in it, we take care of them. That love shines through, just beaming in all his poetry. And one thing this prophet and poet insists is that when we take care of the land, water, and air, we are really taking care of people. If we truly care for people, then we take care of our land, our water, our air. And as you might recall from the Christian Bible, in that passage that's often read at weddings, true love is patient and kind, right? It's patient as well as kind, and patient enough in this case to realize that the changes we need to make can't be made in a few months or a few years, not even in one generation. But the time to launch the recovery and renewal of our blue boat home is right here and right now. Because, as Berry says in the final paragraph of his book of essays, Our Only World, only the present good is good. It is the presence of good, good work, good thoughts, good acts, good places, by which we know the present does not have to be a nightmare of the future. The kingdom of God is at hand because, if not at hand, it is nowhere. So be it, and amen. Now, we leave time in our service, of course,